Hello, it's me, Sam Dunnewald. I'm here before the show to tell you that I am kickstarting my first standalone in-print RPG, Band-Aids and Bullet Holes. It's a John Wick-inspired game of bloody revenge inside a tight-knit clique of professional assassins. It's a one-shot capsule game, box set, deck builder, and it's the end result of 3 years of interviews and ideation on all things game design right here on Dice Exploder. If you like the show, if you like how I think about game design, I think you're really going to love this game. I really just want you to know about it. I want you to play it. And you can follow the Kickstarter page right now at a link in the show notes. You can back the game starting May 5th. That's it. Thanks so much for listening, as always. I hope you check out the game. Here's Dice Exploder. Hello, and welcome to another episode of Dice Exploder. Each week, we take a tabletop mechanic and make out with it in the alley outside the restaurant. My name is Sam Dunnewald, and this is episode 2 of our Dice Exploder summer series on love, sex, and romance in RPGs. Alex Roberts and Sharang Biswas are back for round 2, this time with Roll to Seduce, that classic action so many people try to take and even succeed at taking across any number of games. If I roll high enough on my persuasion check, surely the dragon will want to fuck me instead of killing us, right? In some games, yes. Right indeed. This is such a weird dynamic, but clearly so appealing to so many people. And today, Alex and Sharang get into the why and how of it all. That leads to all kinds of places, but in particular, the seductive choice for designers to quantify sex and romance, to put a number on all these ephemeral and scary ideas about sex and romance, presumably so we might better understand them or be able to avoid dealing with how potentially embarrassing and messy they can be. Even if that ends up having some strange knock-on effects. Couple of plugs here for our hosts before we get into it. You can find everything Alex at helloalexroberts.card.co. That's card with two R's. You can also support her on Patreon, and you can buy Starcrossed Love Letters, an expansion of the original Starcrossed, out now on itch and elsewhere. You can find Sharang on Blue Sky, and you can order his new novella, The Iron Below Remembers, a gay sci fantasy book about horny superheroes, archaeologists, and mecha, out now. Thanks to everyone who supports Dice Exploder on Patreon, and let's get into it. Here are Alex and Sharang with Roll to Seduce.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to our very special mini-series here on Dice Exploder. I'm Alex Roberts.
And I'm Sharang Biswas. And of course, we want to give special thanks to Sam for allowing us to host this without his supervision.
Thank you, Sam. We'll be good.
So today's episode, we're actually going to start off with a quote. This is by Paolo Pedicini, who is a very famous game design scholar and designer. And in his talk, Video Games and the Spirit of Capitalism, he says, quote, "From the eyes of a computing machine, everything is mathematically defined and susceptible to rational calculation. Not only time or money, but also natural resources, love, anger, fate, descent. There's nothing that hasn't been formalized in a game, has not been turned into a variable."
Oh, thank you for that very dramatic reading of Pedicini.
I like quoting dramatically. And so that brings us to today's topic, which is...
quantification, representing sex and romance in games via numbers.
And I think the really interesting thing about this is that most RPGs don't have a mechanism for this.
Yeah.
Yet players and GMs often want a mechanism for this. And so very often GMs just go through their tools and see, okay, we're going to have to roll dice. So roll to seduce in this way. So our spotlight mechanic today is actually an unusual one. It's not a mechanic from one game. It is the mechanic to roll to seduce. And in D&D, it might be making a persuasion charisma roll. In Vampire the Masquerade, it might be making a manipulation roll, right? Like all kinds of games have different methods for this, right?
Mm-hmm. And some do explicitly have the seduction role, or the version of this in Kagamatsu is to get the roll in the hay affection, right? Is something right. You can only do when you have a certain this score or that score.
Or in Monster Hearts that we talked about last time, there's explicitly a turn roll someone on roll using the hot skill, right?
That's a move.
There seems to be, sometimes it exists, but often it doesn't. But players seem to always want to, can I seduce this person? Can I turn this person on? Can I hit on this person? I need to roll to find out, right?
Mm-hmm. Which is why we'll also be talking about the Book of Erotic Fantasy in this episode.
That will come up. If you haven't heard of it, it is entirely free on archive.org. It is infamous/famous, depending on your outlook, in the RPG world. It's a D&D supplement for 3.5th edition.
It's worth a read.
So this actually brings up this idea of what is this urge to quantify, right? Like, why do we want to model these things quantitatively? Because obviously, they can be handled very, very subjectively, right?
Yeah.
But when we play role-playing games, a role-playing game is simplifying complex systems into manageable systems very, very often, right?
Right.
And I honestly believe this is one of the reasons we like to quantify. It's this idea of simplification, right? Mm-hmm. A combat scene is very complicated, and yet we simplify it in a role-playing game to make mm-hmm. it work. A negotiation scene is very complicated, but in the Fate system, for example, there are rules for social conflict and negotiation and the social stress track, right?
And even when it comes to things like commerce, like the whole concept of there being like gold or gold points or credits or whatever, like the concept of having like a numerical, objectively valuable currency is not universal in the world, but you can see the appeal of it in a role-playing game because it's just like, this armor is worth this many pieces of gold, right? And we can also talk about relinquishing subjectivity and what happens when we're in more of a barter-oriented thing.
Right. And so games, because there's a simulationist bent, we're not going to go into GNS theory, do not worry.
Yeah, do not tempt
if
us.
If you don't know what that is, you can look it up. But there is this simulation urge, right? We want to be like, how does the armor help me? How does the magic feather help me, right? So there's this urge, and so we want to simplify our complicated system. And so we want to be able to simplify, well, actual romance is complicated and human feelings are messy, but in our game, we want the fantasy of loving someone, of sleeping with someone, of having an intimate, tender moment with someone. So can we simplify it, right? So that is one urge. Another urge, I think, is simply to understand, right? We quantify mathematically. Scientists quantify things to figure out what it is, like how it does things, right?
Mm-hmm.
And to bring it to games a bit, I also extend this idea of understanding to be observing, right? Like we can observe. Yeah. In many people's minds, a game thing doesn't happen unless there is a change in numbers, right? Like, yes.
yeah. It makes visible, right?
Yes, unless there is a mechanic to record it in some way. And even if the mechanic is kind of is less numerical, like write it down on your character sheet, that still is concretizing, rationalizing it, right? I like the idea of rationalism. Alex, we have a quote about rationalism that Paolo Pedicini had, which I think is a really good foundation point for us to think about this.
Yeah, let's make sure we understand what rationalization is. So Pedicini sums it up like, in sociology, rationalization refers to a process of replacement of traditions, customs, and emotions as motivators of human conduct in favor of quantification and calculation. The notion was introduced at the turn of the 20th century by Max Weber in his influential book, The Protestant Ethic and the Spirit of Capitalism. If computer games in their immense variety have anything in common, that may be their compulsion for efficiency and control. So Pedicini's saying that computer games, quote, are the aesthetic form of rationalization. So when we're talking about rationalization, we mean this specific sociological process that has to do with replacing subjective things with, quote unquote, you know, arguably objective things, right? With calculable things.
And Pedicini talked about video games, but in the year Anno Domini 2025, video games and tabletop games are so cross-pollinating that to restrict studies to one of them is, I think, a little bit of a futile exercise, right?
Yeah.
Obviously, if we're talking about shader graphics programming, sure.
Yeah.
If we're talking about larger patterns, it is, I think, important to look holistically at games, to look at tabletop games, analog games, I should say, because LARPs exist, and video games. So I think Pedicini's arguments apply to role-playing games in many ways as well, right?
Totally.
So we talk about this idea of simplifying, we talk about the understanding, we talk about the also of predicting, right? We quantify things so that we can know how to behave and what can happen next, right? So I think these ideas of simplifying, understanding, and predicting can be a really good way to analyze how quantification works in our role-playing games. So which of the pillars would you like to start with, Alex?
My gosh. Well, let me talk about prediction, right?
Because
we're talking about
that.
Models of prediction. So we quantify things in the real world to predict them, right? I planted 5 seeds. I'm going to have it in my mind that I'm going to have 5 carrots. Or I'll have a more complex model. I'll know that I planted 5 seeds. This percentage of seeds is likely to actually grow into a carrot, right? So
that,
a more complex model.
Scales,
right?
All the way up to the current humidity level and temperature are this. How likely yeah. are we to get rain? Let us understand, like, I have a friend who's a meteorologist, and he's like, oh, mm-hmm. yeah, you have to look at the effect of how raindrops evaporate while falling down,
oh,
right?
Man. See,
so
yeah.
Once we can quantify that, we can predict, does the evaporative potential of raindrops increase the chance of snow tomorrow or whatever,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. And so, I mean, we can also talk about how simplifying, understanding, and predicting are kind of at odds with each other.
And linked to each other.
And exactly, and interdependent. So, like, when we're predicting in a role-playing game, we're trying to say, okay, if this happens, then that will happen. And what that means when there's no computer involved, when it's a bunch of people who are maybe taking on the role of computing machines, is that we're voluntarily relinquishing subjectivity, right? So the role to seduce is the most obvious example, because instead of role-playing out a scene between two people and then everyone at the table kind of has to say, do we buy this as a seduction? Does this feel like this is going to work? Everyone is going, okay, we're not going to make those assessments. We talk about reasons why people might not want to make those kinds of assessments. And actually, it's up to the numbers. It's going to be this random number generator and this random number generator. And we're going to add in then these known numbers, and we will let that decide. And again, when we talk about the Book of Erotic Fantasy, we will talk about the many, 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 like, so much more complex than just Roll to Seduce, ways in which that, as a text, is saying, okay, here's a bunch of predictive models for many sex-related things, activities, identities, all kinds of other stuff.
I think we should talk about, we keep saying when.
Yeah, can we just go
now,
off?
Right?
Yeah, okay.
So the Book of Erotic Fantasy, I think, came out in 2003. That's the best data I could find. The data is not in the book itself. I did the PDF of the book that I got from archive.org. I can't find publication data, so I had to Google a bit, and it's like 2003. I refused to look at what AI told me, because often
yes.
it's wrong. In fact, more
yeah.
often than not, it's wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But I could find 2003. And it's a bit interesting. It's a D&D supplement for 3.5th edition, all about sex. It's actually quite comprehensive. They go into pregnancy,
yeah.
romance, consent, temple mm-hmm. prostitution, chance mm-hmm. of conception. But this idea of predicting, there is a 26x26 field table that tabulates mm-hmm. how likely it is for copulation to result in viable offspring for various species. If a centaur hooks up with a dragon, could you
yeah.
have viable offspring, right? And it's a 20x26, which is wild, right? And it's not just a 20x26 table. There are footnotes that the table has. It's yes, maybe, or no. Maybe. These two species may successfully crossbreed, although the mm-hmm. chance of conception is reduced by 30% from the lowest percentage parent. The resulting child will most likely be a half-breed. See Chapter 6, Gods and Monsters, right?
Yeah, yeah. So even when they put a word, it's actually secretly a percentage, which is 30.
Lovely, right? Quantification
yeah,
at
yeah.
its finest. And
uh-huh.
it's really interesting because it's easy to make fun of the Book of Erotic Fantasy, right?
Yeah.
Seeing this, there's a whole thing about when you roll for sexual performance, do you perform well? If you perform well, this is the amount of money you can earn if you are a sex worker, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's a roll for how long can you last while literally pumping in someone using a constitution check, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's easy to make fun of this. But I think the impulse to do this comes from what you said about prediction. We want to be able to predict things in games. We want to reduce subjectivity. And we want, I think, the impulse, right? The reason we want to do that isn't necessarily like something we have to like criticize, or denigrate, I should say, right? Because wanting simple answer to what happens next is the reason, again, we play games. I don't want to have to think about the sun is in your eyes, the rain is in my face, so I can't do my sword strike. I want to be able to be like, my strength is high, I can most likely do a sword strike. mm-hmm. right? That mm-hmm. is the point of games. And also, there is nothing wrong in a GM or other players being ill-equipped to decide something, right?
Yeah.
If you're trying to seduce me and I'm like, I don't know the mind of a crazed, psychopathic warlord, I don't know if how effective your seduction is, let's do the roles to seduce, right?
Yeah. And again, that like that relinquishment is a pleasurable thing in certain ways, right? Right? Like we are deciding what we want to decide about and what we want to kind of be left up to the numbers or left up to chance or to also have a certain amount of uncertainty to it. Right? There is a degree of uncertainty that we actually do want in some of these experiences.
Greg Kostikian, in his book, Uncertainty in Games, argues that uncertainty is the heart of every game. Different kinds of uncertainty, not just randomness, they are not the same thing, but different kinds of uncertainty. And in this case, it is fun to be like, do I seduce the barbarian queen? Nope. Yeah. Whoops.
Or what happens as a result?
Yeah, or the DM, like, there's an only 1 in 20 chance that you do so, right? If you roll 1 to 20 on your D100, you can seduce. Everything else is fail. That is really fun because if you get that small like critical hit or whatever, you can then be like, yay, we managed to do this. This is so ridiculous. Let's go for it, right? I forget who quoted this, but there's, I think Brenda, I don't remember. But one of the famous game designers wrote once, quote, the dice are delicious, end quote, right? Because that's as delicious as comes out, right? So it is easy to make fun of that, but you can see where it comes from. And also, I think people don't often talk about some of the many positives that the Book of Erotic Fantasy has, right?
Yeah, it's kind of a good read in a lot of ways. I mean, it's a very contradictory text. It will absolutely, it's clearly kind of a multivocal thing that seems to say one thing at one side and then another thing at another. But like, I don't know, even just the fact that it's talking about pregnancy and childbirth as a certain kind of consequence of a certain kind of sex, like, I don't know, it's nice to just know that that exists and like to be thinking about that. I think a lot of the things it has to say about consent and particularly player consent feel kind of ahead of its time, like kind of feel like what a lot of folks contemporarily would say. And it's also like the photography in it and examples, like there's sometimes it's very heteronormative or it feels kind of old fashioned in certain ways, but it's actually a pretty diverse set of models.
There are very few illustrations, it's all photographs
a lot of photographs, and it's very, very kinky. And I think that this book is not just concerned with, okay, how do we sort of like model sex in this environment, but actually gets to ask questions like, hey, what counts as a kink in an imaginary world? Because an imaginary world implies imaginary norms. And so then what are the norms that you can be deviating from? And also, what can a kink be in a fantasy world where there are literally different substances, right? Like, maybe your world has latex and leather, but like the example they used is like, what about mithril and scales, right? Like, could someone have, you know, a kink for materials like that? So I think it is actually a very like expansive look. And can I use an example actually? Because one of the things that's in here is a bunch of like classes that you can take that are like specific to sex. And they have right next to each other are Divine Celibate, which is a class that you can take. And there is absolutely a number-filled table of which kinds of bonuses to which kinds of saved and which base attack bonus you get at different levels of this class. And the feats that you write at a second level Divine Celibate gets Virtuous Mind, which is a +2 bonus on will saves against enchantment spells or effects. But then right next to that is the Dominator. And so you can take Dominator like as a class. That also comes with its own bonuses to attack and save and whatever, but also has feats like Aura of Authority. And there's a special like ability that they have, which is like to dominate someone, which can influence their alignment to be more lawful, which like there's so much going on there. So again, like I think this book actually like is very silly at sometimes, but it does speak to a real desire that people had. It is filling in some serious blanks that were obviously in people's other 3.5 edition books.
And I would bet that the authors didn't start by listing every kink and sexy thing and then model it. I would bet that a lot of it was like, oh, these mechanics exist in D&D. Huh, can we apply this to our ideas of sex? And I think it was I would bet that it was an interdependent relationship. And thus the drive to quantify made them think about sexuality more. Because, well, how does alignment figure into this? Do alignment correlate with the will to be kinky? Like, lawful means you want to be a dom, like you were just saying. So I think this drive to quantification brought up interesting thought And I recommend people who are interested in games and sexuality just to take a look at this book. It's on archive.org. Take a look and see what does it say about that.
Hey, campers. Have you heard of Season 5 of 5 GMs in a Trench Coat from Inside the Tent? You haven't? Well, let us tell you about it.
A nice, green, natural regional park. This is Hidden Falls Regional Park. For our purposes in our world, it's a bit larger than it actually is. It is the summer of 1983, and it is all of your first time getting to stay at Hidden Falls.
We promise it's going to be a great time. It's going to be a story of three childhood friends going across the Americas in 1987 using Kids on Bikes, second edition. So grab a blanket, make some coffee. The first three episodes are available now, wherever you get your podcasts.
This episode of Dice Exploder is sponsored by Hero Forge. Hero Forge offers fully customizable tabletop miniatures with dozens of fantasy species and thousands of parts to choose from, all within your browser. And these minis come in a variety of materials, including bronze, color standees, and color plastic options. Or download model files for your minis and 3D print their unique designs right in your own home. Hero Forge also has custom printed dice where they'll stick your favorite mini floating inside a die or put that mini on a keychain. Hero Forge custom acrylic keychains are printed at the same scale as the rest of Hero Forge minis and arrive already attached to a high quality zinc alloy lobster clasp so you can take your favorite character wherever you go. Hero Forge is constantly expanding its catalog of customization options, adding new parts every week, so check back in and see what you've missed. Visit heroforge.com to start designing your custom miniature and dice today. This episode of Dice Exploder is brought to you by Die Meta Dungeon. Die Meta Dungeon is a campaign-length, dungeon-based adventure for the Die RPG that is also a crawl through 60 years of tabletop RPG history. In Die Meta Dungeon, your characters will enter a massive dungeon that grows deeper and more dangerous as more people succumb to the honeyed allure of role-playing games. Dungeon crawl your way through every era of gaming, from the 1970s to the present day, one decade per dungeon level. Survive to the end, and you might learn something. For the first time in the Die RPG, player characters will get to return to the real world between levels of the dungeon, trying to juggle their real-life problems, and maybe even apply some of the important things they've learned about themselves in the dungeon, before being drawn inexorably back into the meta dungeon. It's a classic fantasy mega dungeon campaign with a postmodern twist, and at least 6 months of sessions baked into it. Die Meta Dungeon is on BackerKit through April 2026. This episode of Dice Exploder is brought to you by Orbital Blues Month. 1 month, 6 creators, an entire outlaw galaxy to explore. Orbital Blues is an RPG of sad space cowboys where your crew of desperate and downtrodden outlaws travel across a music-infused space western universe filled with retro-future technology plagued by heartbreak and the haunting shadow of the blues. And through the end of April on BackerKit, 6 creators are all running projects that expand the Orbital Blues universe. Check out Outlaws and Corporations from Soul Muppet Publishing, a book filled with NPCs, adventures, and setting inspiration. Formula Infinity from Plus One EXP, a high-octane space racing adventure complete with bespoke mechanics for racing. Or A Fistful of Stars from Stations, an interwoven series of adventures set on an interstellar train line. Or any of 3 other projects. Each project also comes with a soundtrack from Behold, which you're listening to part of right now, and which you can get as a limited edition cassette tape when you back multiple projects. Orbital Blues Month through the end of April on BackerKit. Check it out.
So with that, I would say let's move on. We talk all about the predictive power of quantification. Which pillar would you like to go to next, Alec?
Can we talk in maybe greater detail about understanding, right? Yes. We quantify things to understand them and make them visible. Because you had some wonderful examples of this.
Yes. So I think this idea of understanding is powerful in role-playing games because you are portraying a different character. And like we use stats and numbers to understand our character, right? Rather than say, well, I don't know, would my character behave this way? You can say, my character has a high wisdom score. So I think they would think really hard about this, right? Or let's say we're playing lasers and feelings. My character has a very low feelings and very high lasers, which go hand in hand, there's just one number. And so I'd be like, so my character would not understand that the robot is trying to make a heartfelt plea towards me. I think the robot's trying to be cold and calculating, right? We use numbers about our characters to understand things. And I think romance and sexuality, because they are more fraught or more complex topics, we can use quantification to try and understand that about our characters, right? Bluebeard's Bride is a brilliant role-playing game about recreating the folktale of Bluebeard. So it's a horror game. It's all about feminine horror. It's written by three women who talk about, like, this game is trying to talk about the horrors that women go through in the modern world. And as you play this game, you go through these various rooms in the house that your new husband Bluebeard has, and they're filled with horrible monsters and torturous things and freakish stuff. And every time you can either rationalize it and say, no, of course we saw the ghost of the woman gouging out her own piece of her own stomach, because yes, a woman must look beautiful for her husband. She was doing the right thing. Or, oh my God, Bluebeard's a dick. Why would he do that? Right? Mm-hmm. And the reason you do the first, the reason you do the second, but either way, you collect tokens of faithfulness or you collect tokens of disloyalty. And the very act of taking a token and seeing on your sheet, oh, wow, I have 2 out of 3 tokens of faithfulness, and we took them because they help us heal. However, we have 2 out of 3 tokens of faithfulness. What does that say about our character and how faithful they are to this monster, right? That is a powerful thing, right? Having this quantification tells us things, helps us understand our character. And I have argued, hopefully eloquently, in both talks and magazine articles, that Bluebeard's Bride is a game that represents cycles of domestic violence and how people might rationalize the violence perpetrated against them in intimate relationships. And so I think the quantification here is a powerful tool in the game's argument about why intimate partner violence can be perpetuated and has cyclical qualities, right? Well, that's a really cool thing. I have another example if you want me to talk about another
one. Yeah, please.
I think about the board game Fog of Love. It's a board game, but actually a very role-playing-y board game. The game makes you role-play a lot. It's really lovely. I do recommend it. It's a 2-player board game published by Floodgate Games. It is designed by Jakob Jaskov, and it's like a rom-com simulator, like two people are trying to form a relationship, and you get tokens that mark your personality, right? So you can get tokens to match your discipline. On one end, are you organized, diligent, and hardworking, or are you disorganized, reckless, lazy? Or it can mark your extroversion. Are you extroverted, sociable, and assertive, or are you introverted, shy, and reserved, right? And interestingly, the binary opposition isn't super binary. You can get tokens in both sides. You can be both extroverted and introverted, right? Because humans are like that. They can exhibit multiplicities, right? And so this game then at the end tells you, well, you're this kind of person. This partner's looking for this kind of person, right? So the game quantifies and allows you to, in your head, form a complex individual. Because actually coming up and imagining a complex individual is very hard, right? People get Nobel Prizes for doing this. It is a very hard thing, right? Like Nobel Prize literature are all about complex characters, right? So having this quantification, while it simplifies, we'll talk about simplifying as well, it does allow gamers to understand and see and create a picture of a kind of fantasy character they want to create, right?
Yeah. I don't know. It makes something, like we were talking about, visible, but it also leads you to other conclusions, like you were saying in Bluebeard's Bride. And it makes something kind of concrete in a way, right? Strings are the other, I think, great piece of quantified understanding. I know we talked a lot about Monster Hearts last time. We'll probably keep talking about Monster Hearts in this show. But this idea of when you do certain things, you gain a string on someone, then your relationship with them has a certain number of strings. And I think really importantly in Monster Hearts, those strings are not shared. It's not like we have some strings between us. It's I have strings on you. And so it's kind of making a statement that all relationships are power relationships to some degree, right?
And I think that is the theme of Monster Hearts, right? Relationships and power.
Exactly. And it forefronts the power dynamic. It says, okay, when you think about your relationship with this person, what I want you to think about for this game and its purposes are what's the power of you have over that person or that they have over you.
I think that's a really good observation, Alex, because the idea of power and relationship, be it a friend relationship or a romantic relationship or a just a sexual relationship, that is a very complicated human social thing, right? And so using strings as this abstract mechanic to track that, I think allows us to grapple with that in simplified way, right? And I think this string is a great bridge into our third pillar of simplification, right? Because it is very challenging to role play a sexual, political power relationship, right? It's a hard thing. And lots of Nordic LARPers pride themselves in doing that in these complex LARPs, right? And so Avery Alder bringing in strings into Monster Heart is a way to quantify and simplify this kind of thing. And like we said, our final pillar that we're going to talk about is the idea that quantifying things helps us simplify. And simplifying can help us both engage with it at all, because it's really hard to engage with these things if we don't simplify a bit. Because there are some things that are just hard to think about, right? There's this concept in anthropology, I think, called hyper-object, or things that are really hard to even conceive of. Climate change, a hard thing to even conceive of without breaking into parts, right? It can be, allows us to grapple with it all, and then it allows us to also examine models and understand all of these are linked. Understanding and simplifying are linked, right? And like, the problem, of course, is that sometimes simplification can be too much, right? Alex, you had an example from the Book of Erotic Fantasy about the oversimplification of appearances?
Yes, yeah. I'm looking here at the appearance scores. And again, what's interesting about this book is that all of this is prefaced by saying, oh, we have a bunch of rules for sex and attraction, but also you can ignore them. And, you know, there will be times, it says, when your characters engage in sex without rolling dice about it, in the same way that there's other things.
I'm going to interrupt you there, because that ethos in D&D of you can ignore them is very different across editions, right? I believe Gary Gygax was very into, no, the DM is the rule keeper, and it is a challenge for the players. This game is like an escape room. The players are challenged, right? The newest 5.5 edition, right? The 2024 edition of D&D 5th edition. That more explicitly says, sometimes the DM, just forget about the rules. The rules are there as a guide. They're not meant to be physics simulation. So the fact that D&D players want to adhere to the rules is not always true, right? D&D itself has said different things about this. But in this 3.5th edition, I think they were slightly more on the side of rules, rules, rules. So this book being like, do whatever, is kind of cool.
And it's so D&D player. This book is so D&D player, because I think, again, you can tell people, here are the rules, you have to follow them, or you can tell people, here are the rules, you don't have to follow them. Players are still going to do what players do. But it's very funny that this immediately, we're talking about oversimplification, like, immediately gets followed by, like, appearance scores. And so different creatures have different average appearance scores, which also, of course, there's a modifier, right? Like, for every skill. And so literally, like, a zombie has an average appearance of 1, but an elf has an average appearance of between 14 and 15. Orcs are between 8 and 9. And then there's also, like,
that a squid has an appearance score.
And bugbear.
But, like, what am I doing? Like, I can see, okay, I can seduce a vampire, sure, but what am I going to do with the squid?
Yeah, it also makes, I think, truly, I mean, we talk about how games make statements. This supplement asserts that copper dragons are hotter than red dragons. Sound off in the comments. Like, that is a controversial statement. Right. And it's also funny because, like, we know how attraction actually works is pretty subjective. And I mean, I feel like I know people personally who would be like, how is an elf hotter than an orc? How dare you?
Right. Because that's like saying twinks are hotter than bears. That's literally what that's saying.
Exactly, right? That there is just kind of an objective attractiveness that things have. And
that,
like,
the divine mind has decreed.
Yeah, right?
In the book, newest, like, we talk about it being self-contradictory. The book also says, however, people are more likely to be attracted to their own species. And yet, there's a table that says dwarves have a plus 0 while elves have a plus something else, right?
Yeah.
So who has decided, what is the baseline? Who is it being compared to? Who is being attracted to these dwarves and elves? God, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Gods, I guess, right? So simplification can bring problems, right? Because historically, we have these, in the Western world, there are certain standards of beauty that in the modern era favor light-skinned, thin-slash-muscular, proportionate, certain cheekbones, like certain ideals, right? And that's not everyone's attraction model. That isn't even every Western person's attraction model. That's this weird nebulous thing that we say is what should be attractive, but then not everyone is even into that.
Yeah. And we can also talk about the different functions of attractiveness, right? Like that there is, in fact, a social ideal, but also what that has to do with sexual attraction is like, that's not a one-to-one.
Right. But then they're telling the simplification is very, very useful. I mean, we talked about it a little bit already, but like, Monster Hearts, again, has a hot score, right? A hot is actually kind of a broader thing than just how hot are you. But one of the things it is how hot are you, right? But in Monster Hearts, I think it works very differently. Because in D&D 3rd edition, there's a drive to simulate a lot. Let's see how granular we can get. How granular can we get? They're like a million skills, right? If you haven't played D&D 3rd edition, move silently and hide are two different skills, right? Listen and spot are two different skills. Persuade, diplomacy, lie, all of these are different charisma skills, right? Making something granular in D&D is a very different argument than in Monster, which is like, yeah, we're going to just hand wave that. Especially because Monster is a game about people seducing each other in a fucked up high school full of monsters, right? And the arguments about hot and not are part of the arguments about how teenagers view themselves and talk about each other, right? So there is a different resonance when Monster Hearts has a score for how hot you are versus when 3rd edition D&D, which is super simulationist, has a score of how hot you are, right? They do different things. Again, this comes into the idea that games cannot only be rationalized, right? Pettuccini says there's an inherent computability when it comes to games, but they are also art objects, and we do interpret art objects, right? And so simplify sometimes can be great and sometimes can be a bit more problematic in that way, right?
Mm-hmm. And then we could ask the question of, can we ever actually relinquish our subjectivity, right? Like, no matter how much we quantify or say, like, well, this is what the rules say, or this is what the numbers say, or this is, you know, that's the dice roll. Do we ever really stop interpreting that, I wonder, right?
And I think the beauty of role-playing games is we lean on that. We lean on that. Yes. We don't stop interpreting, right?
Yeah.
So interestingly, I'm going to move us on to another example. If you played Numenera or the Cypher system, Monty Cook Games' flagship system, it's a fairly crunchy system, right? It has a lot of number stuff. However, they do have a cool supplement called Sex in the Ninth World, Love and Sex in the Ninth World. And that's quite interesting because unlike A Book of Erotic Fantasy, which came out in like 2003, and Numenera, which I think came out closer to 2013, right? Mm. Love and Sex in the Ninth World book is more of a world-building book. It talks about what does love and sex mean in the Numenera world. Numenera world is Earth, but 1 billion years in the future, i.e. an unimaginable amount of time in the future. Again, you cannot imagine, it's very hard to imagine billion, right? And that's why we don't like billionaires, because they have more money than we could ever even imagine. Why would they need that? Moving on. But what does sex and love mean in this kind of world? It's a really cool book. It's a really interesting piece of world-building. And only mechanical things are about items and diseases, because games love to quantify diseases. I think it's funny how games are like, this disease does this. The one thing is bad, it's just funny. So that's quite interesting, right? Charlotte Germain, I think, was the main author of that book, very much is like, you know, love and sex, leave it more up to the GM, which of course is an argument, right? Saying that leaving this up to the GM of the group is not necessarily, like, a lot of, I am going to say, non-nuanced thinkers think that this is the only way we should have sex and romance, right? We can never have numbers, whatever. And we've talked about this idea of why quantification is useful, right? And leaving everything up to the GM of the group, sometimes or very often, the group will be like, well, there are no rules for it. We're just not going to engage with it because we are not equipped to engage with it, right? And so then the game will end up not having any relationship mechanics or relationship anything. And that's a shame because we like we said last episode in our intro, we think there should be more exploration of romance, sex, relationships, and games, right? And so while it does a really good job of not falling into silly traps like attractiveness scores, does it not talk enough about mechanics of that? That's something that is a debate, right?
Yeah, yeah. I think that's worth asking about. And Shauna Germain, of course, also a very accomplished erotica author, right? She's published a ton.
Right.
And I think
so we can't say that Shauna Germain was thoughtless about this, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Is very thoughtful about these topics.
Mm-hmm, exactly. And so you end up with this very, like, a lot of qualitative information, right? A lot of, like, here's what you could play with. But yeah, you're right. That there's an argument to be made that, okay, you can tell me lots of cool things about this world, but are you giving me anything mechanically to grapple with, right? Like, games are kind of about what their mechanics are about to, you know, whatever. That's its own argument that I could make.
That's its own argument. Yeah, yeah. You know, yeah. Role-playing games, straddle that, blah, 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 right? But talk about this idea of mechanics now. There's a model that's used a lot in video games, and so that gets used a lot in other kinds of games. As we said, they're kind of interdependent art forms. This idea of that Michelle Clue very eloquently in a GDC talk and in her book, Passion and Play, A Guide to Designing Sexual Content in Games, I think we referenced that in the last episode, talks about the idea of kindness coins, right? Think of your Mass Effect game or your Dragon Age game where you have these companions. If you're nice to them enough times, in essence, you're giving them, quote, kindness coins, end quote. Mm. So they're not explicitly called that, but that's what they are, kindness coins. And every time you're nice to them, your relationship goes up until you hit a threshold. And that threshold means you can now have a love scene with them, whether it's a heartfelt, I love you, or it's like a put your dick in me, daddy, or whatever. I don't think anyone ever says that in Dragon Age, but you know what I mean.
Their loss.
Right? But this idea of, like, be nice to companions enough times and then they love you, right?
It's a vending machine, right, is the metaphor. Like, the little snack, the little treat will come out if you put the right number of coins in.
And Clue argues that this is very simplistic because it doesn't take into account the varied ways humans are attracted to people, right? Mm-hmm. The reasons that humans like you. Like, they could like you because you're a bully to them. They could like you because you show kind. They could like you because you share the same religion as them. Dragon Age 3 does a good job. Solas will only date you if you are an elf, because Solas is like an elf supremacist, sort of. Well, they're more complicated than that if you play Dragon Age 4. But whatever, right? People can be attracted to you for a variety of reasons, and often these kind of coins don't take that into account, right? And Michelle Clue suggests another model that she calls Chemistry Casino. And she focuses on video game, but Alex, you have a really good example that illustrates this idea of player chemistry a bit more, right?
Yeah, yeah, that there's still numbers involved, but that it has more to do with chemistry rather than sort of right action, right? You're not earning sex with this person. But so I contributed recently to the How to GM Romance Guide that Metalweave Games is putting out. And Sebastian Yue is constructing this, like, romance system for that is really informed by dating sims. And those are the subjects of the kindness coins critique, right? Is that you just have to do the right thing, get your stats to a certain point and give the right gifts or whatever, and then you will sort of obtain sex from the NPC. But I think Sebastian Yue, like, is translating the dating sim model to role-playing games, which involve human beings at a table, really well. So basically, if there's a romanceable NPC, then the GM is tracking an approval score. And that can be from 0, which is, like, completely neutral, to, like, negative 100, hostile, or positive 100, totally enamored. And obviously, romance is much easier when they're incredibly enamored with you, when their approval score is high, and it's going to be much more challenging if it's low. But how you increase your approval score is by embodying the NPC's values, siding with the NPC in an important conflict, or sympathizing with the NPC, like doing things or expressing or enacting values that align with the NPC's values, right? And so I think it's interesting, because obviously the approval score does that making visible thing that we were talking about, that it offers this understanding, okay, how can I actually look at and make objective how much this person, like, is into me or approves of me? But at no point is it like, this score now equals you get this thing from them. It's just a way to have something that is both objective, but is still subjectively interpreted. And so they are more likely to connect with you or do things that you're into or side with you or show interest if you have been doing these things that increase approval score. But it says quite explicitly that, like, That doesn't mean that you need a certain approval score in order to get sex from this NPC. And in fact, I think there's a really interesting question about, like, what does sex with an NPC look like when you have a really, really low approval score? Like, that's something that happens in real life. People don't necessarily like each other if they're really into each other, and they don't necessarily the other way around. So it has that flavor of something in a Harvest Moon, you know, or a classic dating sim in your Tokimeki Memorials and so on. But actually invites you to have this score that is now like plain, it's there, it's quantified, but that then still requires you to do that subjective interpretation at the end to say, how is this scene going to go if this NPC has an approval score of 20 or of 90 with me?
And a powerful thing I think is that this does not actually preclude the role to seduce mechanic, right? Yeah. Because mm-hmm. all of these approval things could be like modifiers, right? They yep. could say you are more likely, because Michelle Kuhl actually makes a very interesting point in her chemistry casino discussion, is that even if you meet all the requirements that someone has in a partner, there could still be no spark. And Michelle Kuhl likes this idea of a little bit of randomness to be like, sometimes there is a spark, sometimes there doesn't. And that's powerful for Clue in that romance, is it super predictable, right? We talk about quantifying as predicting, but is that oversimplified, right? Like sometimes you just don't spark with someone, right? I have been with so many guys where I'm like, I find you attractive. We have the same kinks. We like things, but then we have sex. I'm like, I didn't think that had a spark. Like it wasn't bad, but like, I don't think I'll pursue that again because I don't think we had a spark. Or I have no idea why.
Right? There is this magic. There is this unknowable thing, right? It's like, I really liked their profile on the dating app, but then we meet and it's just, there's something, right? There's chemistry. And so we've kind of been talking like, okay, role to seduce as like, not a great thing, right? I feel like my default assumption about that is that, you know, it implies certain weird coercive things, but like actually introducing the element of randomness feels resonant. It feels like that is actually how sex works.
Yeah. And the final example I want to bring up is an unusual one. I think it's very strange. It is from D&D's Strixhaven, A Curriculum of Chaos. So it is the D&D version of the Magic the Gathering set Strixhaven, which is set in a magic university. It's a lovely setting. I wrote a little bit for the Magic the Gathering side of it. So, disclaimer, I guess. I wrote for it. It's actually really fun, but I also love magic schools. And the D&D side of it, you're college students. So, of course, friends and romance have come into play, and there are all these like student NPCs that you can meet, all of whose portraits you can actually find on different magic cards. But it's interesting because when you meet these people, you can hang out with them, and the book says, quote, when a character interacts with a student NPC, that character's player decides which to follow, friendly response or rivalrous response, end quote. And then it goes on to say, if it's a friendly response, you get a +1 relationship point. If it's rivalrous, you get a -1. So here, I, as a player, tell the DM, I'm going to do a friendly response and get a +1. Right? This is very different from the way D&D normally goes, right? And I think they were doing this because they're like, oh, we want people to feel comfortable about romances and not uncomfortable. But that, again, takes away any humanity from those players. Like, what am I doing? What if, like, look at these characters. Behedam Rampart Suvij, in my game when I ran this game, was kind of a prick. And he would only like you if you showed prickish tendencies. Like, he respected that, right? If instead the player gets to say, no, it is friendly and it would be a +1, then that takes away the idea that Behedam Rampart Suvij has his own preferences, right? Even though it helps in allowing the players to decide upon the fantasy which player they want to romance because they get to say +1, -1, right? But then the other thing that this spotlights, and this is not the only thing that, in fact, most games do this, is when you have a certain level of friendship with them, they give you boons. And if you become beloved with them, which could be romantic, it could be platonic, it doesn't have to be romantic, which is, I think, a really good move that the book made, you get special inspiration, beloved inspiration, right? And this means, in essence, that the point of having friendship and relationships is to mine them for relationship, for power, right? You get boons and you get inspiration, right?
Yeah.
Which is common in video games, right?
Yes. Yeah. The idea that if you want to be nice to people, it is to get something from them. Right.
Right. And it might be the sex cutscene, which is hot, whatever. But more often than not, in many video games, once you get a certain level of relationship with them, you get a mm-hmm. bonus, or they get a bonus, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think that's an interesting question. Like, what is the point of romance and sex, and why are we quantifying it and mechanizing it in this game, right? That's a really interesting question.
Mm-hmm. Why am I rolling to seduce? Is it because there's something interesting that I want to happen? Like, am I putting out this vulnerability, right? Rolling implies the possibility of failure. Mm-hmm. Am I putting out this vulnerability in the hopes of having a meaningful experience or connecting with someone, or in some sense offering them something, right? Or is it because I want something, whether it be the sex or the plus one that I'm going to get at the end of it?
Right. Pedicini writes, quote, "Interpersonal relationships are regularly instrumentalized. The other exists only as a function of the player," right? Does the romance exist only to make you feel better? Like, the D&D thing kind of does. If I can decide, yes, I'm the romancer, you have no say in it, it exists only to fulfill my fantasy of having a college romance, which is not a bad thing. So that is a function of a role-playing game that is very valid, to simulate a college romance. But it does mean that the NPCs here are instrumental to the player, and rather than having a, I don't know, if you want a rich world that a player could fail in and explore and grow from. A character, sorry, could fail in, explore and grow from, right?
Yes. That question of gratification, right, is where we land.
So yeah, so next time you roll to seduce, or roll to turn on, or roll with persuasion or whatever, hopefully you'll think about what this idea of quantification is actually doing.
Yeah. What am I actually rolling for? Oh my gosh.
Thank you for listening to us again. And thank you again to Sam for hosting us. Alex, do you want to tell us about yourself, or tell the readers about yourself?
Sure.
Readers, again, listeners.
They can read if they want to. They can read between the lines. I'm Alex Roberts. You can find most of my stuff at helloalexroberts.card.co. You can go hang out with me on Patreon, patreon.com/helloalexroberts. That's where I tend to post thoughts about role-playing games. And I'm probably on Blue Sky as well, probably under that same thing. How about you, Sharong? How can people get in touch with you?
Tell the listeners one project of yours that you want to
check out. Okay, right. Yes. Oh my gosh, I forget everything.
Talk about the expansion to StarCrossed.
Thank you. Okay. And one thing that I would love if people checked out is StarCrossed Love Letters just got nominated for the Origins Award for Best Supplement. Ung wrote for it, so you know it is the premium, the cream of the crop. It is basically just a bunch of like characters, different ways of playing the game StarCrossed. So if you've ever wanted that game to be online or without a tower or three player or one player, check out StarCrossed Love Letters. How about you, Sharong? Can you please mention some cool stuff that you're involved in?
Yeah. So I'm Sharong Biswas. I'm a game designer, a writer, interactive artist, and professor in New York City. Well, currently in New York City. Who knows? And you can find me on Blue Sky at Sharong Biswas, or Instagram, to use less, as Sharong Biswas. You can find me on itch as astrolingus.itch.io. And I am, my editor would love it if I keep talking about my book, my new book that came out this year, which is called The Iron Below Remembers. It is published by Neon Hemlock Press. It is a sci-fi fantasy-ish book. It is very gay. It is a novella. It is not that long. And it's been getting some good reviews. Like, people say good things about it. It's very gay, and it is, I like it. I talk about complex relationships between gay men, one of whom happens to be a superhero, and the other one who happens to be an archaeologist. But it features giant ancient Indian mechas and how they influenced the course of history and made India colonize the world. Yay.
Awesome. Okay.
So thank you for listening again. We have an interesting third episode coming. And in the meantime, listen to more of the Dice Exploder podcast, because they have some really insightful speakers. And Sam is a very intelligent interviewer. And also, hopefully, Sam will add some homework to this episode, because he loves adding homework. Oh, yeah. And there's some really clever, thought-provoking homework pieces that he does. So,
If there's homework, do the homework. All right. Thanks for joining us, everyone.
Woot.
Bye.
Okay. And
thanks again to co-host for being here. Then I'll replug the co-host stuff. Then I'll plug my own stuff, social media, Blue Sky specifically. If I've written a blog post about the episode, I'll plug that. Our logo is designed by Sporgaree. Our theme song is Sunset Bridge by Purely Gray, and our producer emeritus is Sam Dunnewald. And if there was ads in the episode, our ad music is by Travis Tesmer, or by Sam's boy, Travis Tesmer. And thanks to you for listening. See you next time.